There we go. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I've got you. Got you.
I've got you too. Are you recording from your phone?
No, I'm on my iPad. I'm not recording. Are you recording it?
Are you videoing or something from your phone?
Just from my iPad, yeah. Come through okay?
Yeah, perfect. But it's just, it was just sort of long and narrow. I mean,
hold on.
It makes no difference. Oh, that's full screen, yeah. Perfect. Look at that. Whatever's easiest for you.
The only thing is, I end up looking over here then instead of at the camera. Do you want to try that? That's better for me if it's all right for you.
Yeah, that's too easy. Too easy.
Oh, good.
You've got the morning off. Flexible.
it's my schedule now.
Yes.
I mean, technically, I'm never off, but technically, I'm never on either. So there we go.
It is an interesting aspect, isn't it? Like when you're self-employed, like I can see how it's not for everyone.
Definitely.
You know.
Definitely.
Sunday morning something actually last weekend we were up at the Whit Sundays, went whale watching and stuff, and then one of my coaches, we had everything planned, I was coming back, so I missed the Monday morning session, coming back for the Monday evening session, and she texted me and just said, I'm sick, I'm vomiting, whatever, and it didn't matter, like I had to, it didn't matter, we're on a boat, it didn't matter, you know, it was just like, yep, cool. We got to get this sorted. Make sure another coach can come in. Are the programs? What's happening with the private clients?
I mean, I think that's why you have to do what you love, right? Because then, if someone calls me on a Sunday with something to do with our brand and needing to do something, it's a cool one, because I'm not doing it for anyone else. I'm doing it for us.
Yeah.
So let's, you know, life and what, you know, if you can get your life to be your work in a good way, then it's all good, you know. I'm trying to incorporate the kids into sort of meetings and explain what we're doing, and this is a CAD, this is how we design stuff, you know, so they're picking up on it and they're understanding the process, and I think that's as much an education for them as going to school, you know.
Yeah, because that's interesting. I sometimes worry that parents, we overcorrect on our own deficiencies, and I'm super aware of this. Like, you know the dad who never competed at a high level, but suddenly he wants his kid to, you know, compete in sport. Yeah. And I want my kids to learn to sell, and I know that is one of my weaknesses.
Right.
Just that whole process, and we've got a mango tree up at the back of the property, and we kind of tinkered around with last summer, but this summer, 100%, we're going to make, I don't know, mango chutney. I don't care what we make. And then we're going to
It's irrelevant. Yeah. It's the process of getting them to understand.
Exactly.
Strange coincidence. So we've moved. We're struggling to get my eldest into school because they're full. So we're going through an appeal process. Chances are it's going to take a month or so. She loves vegan baking, so we've got a camera set up. She's going to start doing some pieces to camera, talking through how she's doing it. We'll set a YouTube channel up and maybe make an ebook off the back of it. And irrelevant of whether it makes any money or not, I just think it's a great process for her to understand. Look, you can do anything. It's 2020. You can do anything. You've got a camera. You've got a camera now that like is TV quality from 15 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just do whatever it is you like. Just do it.
And it's interesting because, I went to a very boys-only boarding school, you know, that single-sex, rugby was everything. You would have probably, in the Australian system, it's the GPS schools, I was at one of those.
Sure, yeah.
And I love my school, I bought into the culture, you know, but I wonder how much it's held me back in terms of that selling, that marketing, those kind of skills, and then off the back of that, getting into a profession like strength and conditioning, where it's, it's frowned upon. He's a sellout market, you know, and trying to break that. And Ollie, it's super, super interesting because I've opened up this mentorship program, and one of the toughest things to do is convince someone, hey, you know what, your time's actually valuable. And yeah. I'd actually be interested in your thoughts, because yeah, my mentors mentored me. Not all of them mentored me for free. Like I did some work for them where they profited off me, and I don't judge them at all. Like I see it as a transfer of value. So I got experience and I got to work with athletes that I probably wouldn't have without their help. But at the same time, they probably got paid. But it is a sales in strength and conditioning is a dirty word.
It's uncomfortable too, right? I don't like it. I'm part of a business now. A part of that business is we need to sell stuff, otherwise we're going to go bankrupt.
Yeah.
But still, even now in that space, it's uncomfortable. If you don't want it, don't buy it. Do you know what I mean? That's my natural position is, all right, fine. If you don't want it, don't buy it. I'm not going to persuade you to do it. I'm not going to persuade you to buy it. But, you know, sales is, it's the lifeblood of a company, you know. You have to be making sales, otherwise it's just a nice pet project that's going to cost you money.
So have you been uncomfortable with that as a strength and conditioning coach back in the day?
Yeah, I think so.
I say back in the day, 2 months ago.
Because I've been in professional sport, I don't think I've had to necessarily outwardly sell it. I guess I would sell an interview. That would be, you know, that's where I would probably be doing my selling. I'm selling myself, my product. This is what I will bring to the club if you choose to employ me.
Okay, so let's talk about that. So did you sell yourself in your interviews?
I've done a couple of interviews. I feel like I absolutely nailed it and didn't get the job at the end of it. So I don't know how well I've been selling it, but let me just think back. I mean, as you know, and I'm sure you sort of you talk to the people you're mentoring. A lot of the time, if it's been advertised, it's too late anyway. The ship sailed, you know. And I've got a couple of jobs through friends of friends, and that's the reality is. And there was an interview process, but even during that interview process, they'd had a pretty heavy recommendation from someone they valued. It was mine to mess it up, you know. I basically just had to not offend anyone during the interview, and chances are I was going to get that job. Even going over to the Reds, I'd worked with Dean Benton, an incredible practitioner and someone that's been in the game for long enough where he sort of truly knows what's bullshit and what's going to work. And we'd worked together. He obviously knew Damien Marsh really well at the Reds. They were looking for someone, and that, you know, I still had to interview, but that whole process came about through a pre-existing relationship.
So was there any, have you had a position that you've got applying cold?
The original internship with Leicester Tigers, I think, was probably the only thing, I applied cold. And obviously got it. Everything else has been through pre-existing relationships or rumor mills, and you know, some, I think, taking the front foot and calling a couple of people and stuff. But the jobs I've been for and interview, I've been through an interview process, I've ended up getting pretty close, but not quite getting the cigar at the end of it.
That 100% reflects. I actually tweeted about this the other day that I have never got a cold job. It's been through a recommendation, to the point where the one time it was I sent my resume through so they could create the advertisement for that.
right, because they have to jump through a couple of employment law hoops and whatever. You can't be seen to just hooking your mates up with jobs and whatever. And I understand that. But from the flip side of me getting to a point in my career, then I was recruiting. Of course, if someone goes, listen, Ollie, this guy, he will do everything you need to do. Of course, like, you, at least you're at the top of the pile. And, you know, I of course wanted to do my due diligence, and we, you know, interviewed people. But there were people coming into the interview that I was like, look, if this guy says he's good, he's pretty good. And from a recruiter's point of view, you're almost looking for who's going to cause me the least, who's going to execute on what I need them to execute on and cause me the least amount of problems. That's the reality of what you're looking for. Is he a stable guy? Does he have good personality references from people I know, and I trust their opinion, and can they execute on X, Y, and Z, which is what the role we're advertising for. And if you can, if you find someone where you tick both of those boxes, you know, you're pretty inclined to go with that over an elongated interview process.
So, okay, so let's explore that a little bit. So what is your process, okay? So either someone gives notice or the budget's increasing and they're saying, hey, we're going to shift the team around, so there's a rehab coordinator, or, you know, you need an assistant S&C.
Yeah.
What's your first step? Give the ring around?
Straight away, yeah, straight away, four or five WhatsApps out to guys that have been in the industry a long time. Do you know anyone? Anyone who you reckon you could fill this spot, even before we'd even think about, you know, advertising and what have you. And that's, you know, that's reality. I'm not sure the employment bureaucracy would be too happy to sort of hear that, but that's the reality. You know, if there's someone like Dean Benton or Damien Marsh who've been in the game, you know, over 20 years, they're going to have a good list of people that they rate highly, they can vouch for, and you know, they can recommend. And why wouldn't you go through that process like that?
Yeah, one of the things I say for this process is, you know, there's almost things that stop you from getting a job. So if you don't have a certain level of qualification, you're just not going to get into the second pile or go yeah. through that first gate. But one of the most powerful things, and this is applying from my internships all the way through to, like, sometimes on a, you know, the state body will say, hey, can you jump on the panel or whatever? And that reference to see Ollie Richardson or Dean Benton or Damien Marsh on there, because then I know I can call them and say, mate, tell me.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of my favorite questions there is, what can this person improve? And kind of almost force the reference to, in a corner, like, hey, Marshy, what can this person, and then you find out they're real, you know, but they're going to be honest enough with you. Because no one wants to put their name to someone who's going to be a dickhead or,
mate,
you know,
for sure. And conversely, when people ask me for a reference, I'm 100% honest, because I'm not gonna grey out a couple of areas that might come back, and, you know, in 6 months' time you find out he's doing coke in the change rooms before games, and he comes back and go, Ollie, what, do you know what I mean? You said this guy was straight down the line. And that's reality. You know, that's on my name. And our industry is tiny, although it seems big, it's tiny. You know, there's no one that me and you will never have heard of or can't get to by one call to someone.
Well,
because
yeah,
we've been around long enough that we can, you know, we can find out the details.
I actually say I don't like to get preachy about it, but I do say to my interns, guys, do you understand that everything that you do is a job interview? Because I'm going to be honest, and everyone else is going to be honest, because no one wants to risk it. But my saying is two phone calls. Within two phone calls, I can find out about anyone in strength and condition, at least in Australia. So within that, like, and Ollie, it's bad, because, like, I've had a young intern. She was really, really good. I trusted her with the business and stuff, and she got kind of poached, which is fine. Like, when you run an internship program, you accept you're going to lose people.
Yeah.
She tried to actually take my clients, and I had to sit down with her and say, like, you've just messed up the, like, 2 years of your resume.
You're blacklisting yourself here. Fine. I'm not saying don't do it, but if you do it, you're going to blacklist yourself in this profession.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I found out afterwards, these clients came to me after the fact. They just said, hey, look, you know, they were embarrassed about it from a number of different reasons. And they came to me and said, look, this is the situation. And I called her, and I'm like, these are lessons that I want to get out to young coaches. Like, put your best foot forward on every single thing you do, because someone will be watching or listening, or someone will know, and the knock-on effects are just never worth it. And basically what I'm trying to say is take a long-term view to everything that you do. Long-term,
I agree.
Invest.
And the reality is, if your product is good enough, people will come and they will find it. Yeah, there's a sales aspect to it and a marketing aspect to it. But if you genuinely have a product that is going to improve people in one way or another, whatever the realm, people will come and find you eventually. As long as you're consistent and you know, like you say, keep putting your best foot forward, people will find you.
Yep, 100%.
Sure.
Okay,
funny, mate. Just, I just wanted to touch back on something you said about sort of qualifications. So you sort of sit with guys who have been in the industry for a while, like ourselves, and the importance of data, the importance of your qualifications day to day seem to diminish as you sort of go up through the ranks. Yet we still have the conversation that you can't get to a certain level without those qualifications. So
yeah,
I remember when I started, it was basically you needed a bachelor's and you were competitive if you had a bachelor's. Some people were in it without that, and they're just, you know, ex-players maybe, or they're particularly good professional development resumes or whatever. But then I know 5-6 years later, it was like a master's was the minimum. Like you're not going to get anywhere without, you're not going to get a foot in the door without a master's. And now there's like people applying for internships and PhDs and what have you. And then conversely, I certainly found, anyway, as you went up through the chain and you ended up becoming sort of a head of performance, whatever, you needed to be more of a generalist than a specialist. So the guys with PhDs who are super specialized in one area, they're becoming less and less useful because you just need a good understanding of everything that's going on within the team and within the profession. But having, you know, it's not necessarily, you don't necessarily need a specialist area. Okay. You'd be really good at a lot of things. So it's all like, we talk the same things are, without this you won't get in, but actually when you're in, you probably don't really need that. So it's a bit more backwards.
Who's driving this? Because Ollie, so I do like the idea of a degree, and I actually say, I borrowed this from someone, I didn't come up with it, but basically get the minimum that you can. Even my thoughts have evolved there. In Australia, there's a 3-year degree and a 4-year, and I used to encourage everyone to get the 4-year. Now I'm just saying, get the 3. I am an exercise physiologist in Australia, which means that private clients can get government funding to come see me, and then they get rebates on their private health.
Yeah, for sure. You know,
I think 3 out of 150-odd members access that. It's not worth my time. Like, it really isn't. And so now I'm saying get the 3-year degree. But who's driving this thing? Because all my UK followers on social media, if I say, guys, just get the minimum and go build your experience and then also build your, like, develop your relationships. And they go, no, you need your master's, you need your every qualification. But you and I are talking here, everyone that I talk to face-to-face, every decision maker says qualifications, you know, you don't really need it, or as you've just said, like it's less and less important. Yeah. But someone is driving that. So where is that happening?
I'm not sure, other than maybe even higher up the chain. I do get it, right? We need some conformity to the profession. So you just can't rock up after a weekend's course, sure, and go, I'm a strength conditioning coach. I want to, you know, this is what we're going to do, 1,000 burpees and a marathon. You know what I mean? I understand we need conformity, we need some standardization. And I like, you know, Dan Baker and the ASCA have been working towards standardizing experience and qualifications to pay rates and what have you. So I understand the need for that. I think potentially there's a perception from club hierarchies that we want, you know, if we've all of our staff have PhDs, masters and degrees, that's good, right? We look good, we look solid, we look like, if the, you know, we're doing the best we can do, we've got the best in here. And that's one of those things that on paper, yeah, it probably does look like that. But the reality is, by the time you could have done your masters and PhD and what have you, you know, that's 10 years of coaching experience coming straight out of a BSc, you know.
That and the former player are two of my arguments. If you take 3 30-year-olds, one got their 3 or 4-year degree and then just coach club, coach school, coach under 12s, all that kind of stuff. Then person two was masters and PhD and academia and stuff. And that's not to say that they can't coach, but it's just a different priority, different. Yeah. And then the other one is a former player who's being coached. And I see there's value in that. Like, yep, if I'd worked with a Wayne Bennett as an athlete or a good coach, you can absorb some of their things. But it is different. I mean, you know, we often say, does a good criminal make a lawyer?
Just because you've traveled on a plane doesn't make you a pilot. That's what I was thinking. You know what I mean? I've traveled all around the world, but I can't fly a plane. And that's my argument with players transitioning to coaching. They need to go in the bottom rung of coaching because it's a completely different lens. It's a completely different lens to the one that they used to.
But if you take those three people, so got the minimum degree, like the bare essential degree. I still like the degree, and I don't know why I'm uncomfortable with things less than that, but got the degree and the sort of 10 years experience. Then you got the other academic person, and then you've got the former athlete who retired at age 29 or 30. Like, give me, just knowing that, give me the person who's had 10 years coaching experience in all different males, females, junior, elite, team sport, individual sport, skill dominant or physically dominant. Like, that person, just to me, all things being equal, is just in a way better place.
Yeah. I think I'm, you know, it's confirmation bias because that was my route. So I understand I have a bias towards that. I didn't do a master's, I didn't do a PhD, but when I was 17, I was coaching 14-year-olds. When I was 18, I was coaching 15-year-olds. As soon as I could coach, you know, I was just coaching down the local rugby club in the junior section. And then I was coaching, I think, the county area under 18s when I was, you know, at university and stuff. As soon as I could coach, I was coaching, and I was living it. You know, I was training. I was effectively training as a full-time athlete, even though I didn't have a competition to train for. You know, the profession is changing. I nearly called it an industry. Then the profession is training.
What's the difference? I don't know the difference between those two.
I don't know either. I just
Vern Gambetta always says.
Vern told me not to call it, and he's the granddad, and I just do what the granddad says.
Okay, because
I do understand the nuance of what he's trying to get to. Right, it's like, listen, if you want to be respected in the profession, well, start calling it profession. You know what I mean? Like, doctors aren't calling it they're not in industry necessarily. That, you know, they're a profession and what have you. But
it's kind of like a blue collar, white collar thing.
Maybe it's just semantics. Maybe I don't know, but I understand the root of it. In that we're trying to get a better standing for physical performance managers in the construct of professional sport. You know, I still think, even though there's money in that profession, I still don't think for what we bring to the party, I think that we are undervalued as a part of professional sport, because no one spends more time with the players. No one has their finger on the heartbeat of the team more than the strength and conditioning staff. No one is constantly looking at a player from multi different angles. It's not just about technical and tactical. You know, we're looking at physical. We're looking at where are they mentally? How's their recovery? How's their home life? You know, we're looking at that, I think, more so than the technical staff. And I understand why people that have done this for a while want more for the profession. You know, they want a higher standing for the profession because it's critical. You know, and I tell you what, when things go wrong, the physical performance staff are right up there on the list of people that are gonna get the bullet. It's not in rugby. It's normally it's defense coach or fitness. That's the first two. The first two are gonna take the bullet for sure.
I've influenced, but I've never been a selector. Have you been at the selection table? Like,
yeah, I've been there, I've
as a selector or an influencer of the selectors? If you know.
I don't think anyone would say that I was selecting the team. I've been sat at the table and given opinion, and you know, people have asked, where do you think he's at? Is he going to be able to do 60 minutes straight? Are we going to have to pull him after 14?
Like return to that. So I wouldn't. Stuff.
Yeah, more of an influencer at that table, but I have had a seat at the table, yeah. Ultimately, the head coach is selecting, you know, it's his next on the line.
So the reason I bring that up is because I actually think that's critical for our relationships with the players, is they will be more honest with us because we are not selective. And I'm talking back in my employed days. Like, they're going to be honest, hey, mate, I'm not feeling it, I'm a bit flat. This is really, but they don't actually want the selector to know that because
100%.
And then we've walked this balance of saying, hey, you know, we committed to the athlete, but we also committed to the team. And if that athlete's going to break down at the 60 minute mark or can't do something like that. But I agree with you. Like, I've often, and this is where I've been influencing selections, is being able to say, hey, this guy's a bit flat, or his numbers in the gym are a bit down, or whatever we're tracking, HRV, vertical jump, whatever we want to do, I can tell you that what you've done with him, you have not got a full, complete physiological picture, and he actually either needs to be rested or played off the bench, or he's not quite ready, or whatever the case might be.
For sure, mate. And like, even as you sort of, as personally, as you move up through the chain, the honesty just, it is a mirror of you moving up the chain. So by the time they know you're sat in selection meetings, you're hearing a very
different,
formulated opinion, presentation of their status, you know, because they want to play. Like they want to play. Players don't want to train necessarily, but they want to play. Like, they do this because they want to play, and they don't want you going in there and saying, oh, I don't think he's quite right or whatever. And, you know, there's a financial implication for them for that as well. You know, they don't get the match bonus. They don't get, you know, in a lot of people's contracts, a certain number of appearances mean they get bumped up to a certain contractual level. And they don't want, you know, they don't want you going in there saying, oh, don't pick him, he's not right.
Yeah, 100%.
For sure.
100%.
And I do feel like the S&C coach and the gym coaches, they get the truth.
Yeah.
Because they're in there and, you know, they're lifting and there's a lot of time, you know, even in between sets where there's just sort of dead time and you're just having conversations. And, you know, I think that you get some really good relationships as a strength coach or as a gym coach. You get some strong relationships.
It's been fascinating as I've sort of taken on more and more swimmers, how my relationship with a swimmer, just relative to a coach who they've been with for 3 to 5 years and they've been with me, we're measuring it more in months. And it's exactly what you say. Like, if you think of swimming, they've got a big squad. They are underwater. They are on a long, you know, far distance from the coach, even if the coach is walking up and down or something. But, you know, in a 45-minute gym session, we could probably talk for 35 minutes, you know. And so me seeing them 1, 2, or 3 times a week, my relationship and my knowledge, and they've bought a new puppy and they've broken up or they've just got together or exams or mom and dad, like, it's so the reason I'm telling you this is what you said right in the beginning, we're undervalued. In most of these swimming situations, mom and dad pay or the athlete pays, like, not the coach, but we get an insight that a lot of other coaches don't get because of the structure and possibly even who we are.
I think so. And it's funny. So all of those, what's going on in their life, as you become a head of performance, they become more important to you because you're having that sort of you're having that bird's eye view of stuff, but you get less access to it because you're perceived as, you know, part of the hierarchy then. So then you're in a bit of a, you know, you rely on your S&C coaches and you rely on your physios, but then you also don't want to compromise their relationship by taking that information and presenting that to the head coach. So it's a proper managerial role where you're just trying to not burn bridges, but you need the information and you're controlling what you relay up the chain because, you know, with all due respect, head coaches can be a little bit more cutthroat than you know, perhaps heads of performance. They're like, fine, if it's not right, I'll get someone else, you know.
I think
that's one of the skills I think I became relatively good at, is managing that information, and that's certainly something that I've clung on to as I've moved into business, in that I'm trying to run our businesses as a team, you know. That's all I'm really doing. We have some super creative people, and that's not necessarily me, but I'm just trying to give those creatives and our corporate guys a bit of direction and basically do what I used to do, but do it in business instead of sport.
Let's chat about that, because, you know, one of the things that when I moved into the private sector, and essentially it's called the private sector here, but I mean, it's basically selling to the consumer. When I moved in there, I tried to have my employed mindset. So I just saw myself as a coach, and instead of being employed by one person, I was just getting multiple people and then a few state or national sporting organizations and a couple of clubs. And that's how I saw it. But it was actually through my wife pushing me and saying, no, you got to think like a business person. So what skills do you find that you've kind of carried over and are actually really comfortable in, having been in the performance world? And what skills do you think, like, I've got to work at this?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, like, I sort of touched on that management of people, because even referencing back to our earlier conversation about academia and what have you, it's almost like this is a people game, and I know a lot of people sort of, that's a soundbite from other people and what have you, but it is a people game. If you can't, if you can't connect on a people level, people don't care if you've got a PhD. They don't care if you're the best guy monitoring in the whole universe. Unless you can connect on a human level, it's sort of irrelevant. And I see that in business. And part of my role now is just connecting us with other companies, is just speaking to people within our company and just speaking to them as humans. Like, why do you do this? What do you do this for? Okay, right, how can we pour petrol on the things you really like? Because we want to blow that up, and I want you to do the things you want to do. That's, you know, this is, we only get one chance at this life. Just do things you want to do. And you know what, if you're not great at this, well, what can I do to connect you with someone that can help you bring this up in the most painless way possible, you know? Because obviously people don't like doing things they're not good at, but mm-hmm. if it's an integral part of, you know, what they're doing for us, then we still need to bring those levels up. And I see that as a direct transfer from coaching, you know. Mm-hmm. Powerful people like doing power in the gym. Like, they don't like grinding out heavy load, you know. People that are very elastic, they don't like generally doing 3 rep max squats because they don't get that kinesthetic feeling they get from doing plyos, because they like doing plyos, they're good at it. No, so it's about embellishing the things they're good at and just gradually trying to ratchet up the things they're not so good at mm-hmm. in as painless way as possible. So I see that almost as a direct transfer across, really.
Sorry, just on that, because that's been fascinating. Is in the last few months, I've been doing some corporate stuff, and it's amazing how things that I just think are so simple from a strength and conditioning thing, and a lot of it, Ollie, comes back to periodization. Where do you want to be? Where are you now? You know, let's break it up to smaller. How do we get there? Like, it seems so simple. Like, I kind of feel bad, like, telling these guys stuff. We're talking lawyers and accountants and whatever. And so
that is so true. That is exactly what I'm going through right now. It's okay. Basically periodization of business.
Yep. And it's something that I think we could actually really add value as a profession into, outside of, you know, that immediate dog-eat-dog world of high-performance sport or whatever. But, okay, so you've discussed your strengths. What are some of the things that you maybe wished you had done as a younger coach, or explored or developed yourself to better prepare you for your... Actually, no, sorry, before we even ask that question, can you tell us what you've left high performance sport for, and tell us a bit about Full Reptile? Then let's go to that question.
Yeah, for sure. So part of my career was I moved into mixed martial arts. So when I was at Leicester Tigers, just a side hustle as such is... I got involved in training guys for mixed martial arts. It was something I was interested in. I was fascinated by the sport. It was just a realist sort of, just a realist sport I'd ever sort of seen, really. So I was like, right, well, I want a bit of that. I want to see how I can, you know, get some experience in that, and eventually help to influence that sport and how they prepare for that sport. So anyway, that's a slightly longer conversation, but that happened. I made some very, very deep relationships with some of those guys, because it was, you know, I was effectively preparing them for war, for a fight. Yeah. So because with that nature, you get very close to people, because, you know, they're entrusting you to make sure their bodies are right, because they're going in to fight another human being. Yeah. And there's a certain rule sets that are put in there to stop that being a fight to the death. But effectively, we can't get away from there's two people that are, you know,
trying to kill each other.
Not fighting to death, but it's pretty extreme, you know, especially on a psychological level, it's pretty extreme. So I grew some deep relationships within that sport and preparing people for that sport. Anyway, as we sort of progressed and what have you, we in 2018 we decided that we would like to create something around the lifestyle of training to be better, and training for mixed martial arts. And one of the founders and one of the directors is Dan Hardy, who, you know, had a successful career in mixed martial arts and has transitioned to being a commentator for the UFC, and is an incredible example of embedding yourself in what you do. So he's a lifelong martial artist. If you go to his house is plastered in books about the martial arts, about about everything to do with creating systems and processes toward with combat in mind. And he's genuinely, this is his life. This is, you know, this is his life's work. And we've got some things that are coming out in the future that will sort of demonstrate that to people, that this isn't a job to him. It's not a game to him. Yeah. He's embedded in this. He took himself off to the Shaolin monks when he was 19, I think, in China, and spent a couple of months in, you know, with the Shaolin monks. That's, you know, at 18 or 19, I can't remember when. It's a pretty impressive decision to sort of take. Anyways, long-winded story. So we've started this brand, and we're building it around martial arts and the lifestyle that surrounds that. So Full Reptile Collective is the clothing, training clothing, sort of fashionable post-training wear side of it, which is going really well, and we think we're creating something that is authentic and something people will sort of aspire to be part of our team eventually. Mm-hmm. And then we also have Full Reptile Creative, which is a media team that follows around the UFC predominantly, but also Bellator and anything to do with mixed martial arts. And Dan does an analysis show on there called The War Room, which is on our YouTube channel. Yep. Which again just gives you an insight of how cerebral he is about martial arts, and he breaks down any sort of big fight that's coming up. He'll do a breakdown of each fighter and how they sort of come together, and you know, their strengths versus the other guy's weaknesses, and the other way around. And it's great. It's a great insight. I just watch it as a fan, not even as a business partner. I just watch it as a fan. I love watching them. So that's predominantly that's Full Reptile. There's some other things we'd like to eventually maybe move into the performance gym space with Full Reptile Performance, because that's something that obviously I have experience in, and all of the guys that are involved in the business have either been a professional coach or professional athlete at some stage. So it makes sense that we would, we'd embellish that slightly. And then the sort of last part of that trifecta really is the Hardy Warlett MMA mixed martial arts gym based in Leicestershire and Colville, which again we're sort of growing. We've got a good core group. Difficult time in the world really for private gyms and what have you, and we've lost a little bit of membership, but we're gradually going to grow that up and hopefully make that a sort of go-to place in Europe for mixed martial arts and the people that want to get better at combat and understand combat more and get in shape and do it in a fun sort of fun learning type scenario. That's why I've got to.
And you are CEO of all of that, or just the collective, or everything?
So I basically, my remit is just to give us direction. Is, you know, like I'd sort of touched on before, we have some the guys that run the our media team, I'm so lucky to be coming into an organization that already has super talent like that. So we have some creative designers that do all of our design work. Excuse me. Then we have our creative audio visual crew that just make amazing videos. They're just really good at it. And then obviously Dan, who has one foot in management like myself, obviously is the talent as well. So he's constantly creating videos. He's constantly creating insightful sort of pieces to camera for the YouTube channel. Basically, I'm just going to sit over the top and give us direction, follow up on stuff that needs following up on, driving stuff, you know, because obviously with a group of creatives, we have a million ideas a day. You know, yesterday we were sat in design meetings and there's just ideas coming out, and I'm just sat there going, oh, that's a good idea. It's a good idea. And then once something sticks, and then I'm just going to push through with that and sort of take it to either production or take it to manufacturing and what have you. So it just gives a bit of direction for us.
Okay. Now, I still want to come back to the question about what skills do you think you lack in this, but tell me about the transition, because for many people, you're at the top of your game, super rugby, be in Japan, move the family around. You know, if you had told me 24, 25, I would have said that's the dream, kind of travel with work at high performance.
Yeah.
As I've matured, that became less of a dream. But tell me the thinking behind these two things that are building you at the top of strength and conditioning game. You know, a leader in many respects. and then you decide to give it up to kind of, you know, take a gamble.
It's exactly that. And I'm very conscious that I don't want to come across bitter in any way. I've not, like, I've had enough of the profession. I'm out of it. It's an amazing profession. It's took me all around the world. I've done stuff with it that I just never would imagine I could do. Like moving to Brisbane with the Reds was the dream. Like that was the dream. I couldn't have ever predicted it happening in the way it happened. Loved it. Obviously, day to day is different to the big dream. Like day to day, it's still a lot of hours. It's still a lot of work.
Did you have a family then?
And then obviously. Yeah. So we had our eldest, and we had my son while we were there. So and then as we were leaving, we had our third as well. So as we're transitioning from Australia to Japan, my wife came back to England to give birth. I shot over to England. I shot over to Japan. Then I shot from Japan over to see the birth. Then I shot straight back to Japan. And then eventually they came over and joined me over in Japan. So. I mean, I guess I should shout out my wife for being very, very brave and not sort of standing in the way of doing what we wanted to do. And to be fair to her, she just gets on with it all, and she just takes it in a stride. And you know, that's a tricky time of life for a family, is having kids to start with, but also to be then traveling all around the world while you're sort of doing it. Big props to her for, because it's easy for me, right? I'm just like, right, we're going to Japan. Come over when you're ready. I'm over there. So like I say, anyway, sorry, I've digressed a little bit, but
no, that's all good.
Not bitter at all. I haven't thrown my toys out the pram at all. It's an amazing.
Could you see yourself coming back into it?
I don't think full time. I think I've tasted the making your own schedule. I don't think full time. I'm more than open to some small consultancy roles and what have you, because the irony is, it took me, so 2004 I started as an intern. It took me to 2020 where I'm like, I have a system that I know can improve whatever team you decide to drop that in. Obviously, we have to move some things around a little bit and adapt it to the situation, but I believe in, I have a system that can change, you know, can change the performance of the team. I know that because I'm hypercritical of my own system. And if it wasn't working, I'd be like, shit, I don't know what I'm doing here. I need to go out and I need to get more information and try and improve it. But yeah, the irony is I've effectively exited the profession when I finally got a system that I believe can make a difference. But no.
But to me, that makes total sense, because I've found that if I know what the big cogs are, and you know, take tennis for example, once I felt I'd worked the sport out, and I've got to be very careful what I say here, because I never produced a Grand Slam champion, like, you know, so yeah. You could argue how much did I know the system, but once I understood the sport, the demands and stuff like that, I mean, I suppose in some respect, Ash, I happened to contribute a little bit to Ash Barty, but in reality, you know, I haven't won anything with my, using your term, system. But it was kind of like, okay, I'd like to actually push myself and be a novice again. And that's kind of what's driven me throughout my career, from tennis to BMX, mountain biking, motocross, whatever. So I don't see any irony in it. I see like, hey, wait a second, I'm kind of getting my hands on it. What's the next challenge? Rather than, well, now I've got a system, so I'm just going to dial it in and kind of go through the motions. So I respect that.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. I've come into this role. I have no idea what I'm doing. I haven't spent a day in the business world in my life. But like we've touched on before, I do feel like I have some transferable skills. And the one thing I definitely have is energy and work ethic. You know, like, this is a project that I want to solve. You know, it's like a video game, right? I want to solve it. I want to level up. I want to solve this puzzle. Like, I can sort of see how it works. I'm not quite sure, but sure as hell I'm going to work it out at some stage. And I'm blessed with the people that are around me are of a similar mindset. And we're all just got a lot of energy, got a lot of work ethic, you know, we're going for it. Because the reality is, in professional coaching, you know, you're probably punching out 50, 60 hour weeks without even thinking about it. You know, that's just the way it is by the time you put your game day and recovery day in. And that sort of work ethic is just normal. Like, you don't even blink an eye. So transferring that out into something else, I feel like I can get a lot of done. I can get a lot done in 50, 60 hours in business. Do you know what I mean? That's a lot of time to get stuff done.
Yeah.
And when it's yours and it's something you believe in, and you know, all of us believe in, this is a pretty cool thing to be doing, then it just sort of merges with your life. And like, before we got on this call, we were sort of talking about, it's only work if you make it work. Like, it's not, you know, at the end of the day, we're creating stuff, and we're seeing projects through, and you know, we have a collaboration with another company that we're working on now, and it's just like, we can see it just as a fan. You'd be like, that's going to be really cool when it's done. That's going to be cool. People are going to like that, you know. So it doesn't become work. And you know, we were chatting about, you know, getting the kids involved, showing them what a CAD is, showing them what the design process is, showing them how you have an idea, you do this, then you put it on YouTube, and then people follow it. And, you know, it's a good life lesson for them, that you know, if you find something that you love doing, just do it. Video it, and you'll find a crew of people that are interested in that. You know, it's worldwide now. Anything you put on the internet, you know, you can get people. We do orders to Finland. We've done orders to the Philippines. You know, there's people all over the world that are sort of tapping into what we're putting out there, and it's been fascinating. And I'm really enjoying sort of dragging the kids along with me and just showing them that, you know, what's possible and stuff.
That's awesome. Now, I still want to ask this question: what skills are you lacking? But I want to preface this, because
we're going back to that again.
You know, because again, I know we have a lot of young coaches who listen to this, and I'm quite, you know, I've got my mentorship thing and my internship, and I'm trying. Sometimes I think they look at me and they go, "Gee, you're 42 years old. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm 22. Like." You know, there's this massive gap, and I'm trying to build evidence for them. And there's a story I tell when in 2005, I get appointed as strength and conditioning coach for a private boys school, Brisbane Boys College. And I actually wasn't strength and conditioning coach. I was sports complex manager. So I managed the sports complex, basketball, netball, all this kind of basketball, volleyball, whatever. And off, they kind of tagged strength and conditioning onto that. And while I'm there, I managed to flip that. So I'm a strength and conditioning coach who happens to manage the sports complex. And Ollie, there were a whole bunch of things that happened, which I actually kind of pushed up against. So they had to redo the project, and it was a $2.1 million project. And I oversaw it, but begrudgingly, like, all I wanted to do was be in the gym. That's it. Yeah. And I oversaw this project and the architects and whatever. But the funny thing is, the skills that I learned from that have transferred more than how to set up bench press technique, which I probably would have read 1,000 articles on, or Louis Simmons's whatever.
Yeah.
And so what I'm saying is, at the time, there were skills that I picked up that I didn't want to, but have kind of been way better for me in the private sector, or as I've aged or whatever. And then there've been other things where I thought, oh, wait a second. If I'd done something like this before, then maybe I wouldn't be in this place having to do it now. So that's what I kind of want to explore with this. So, okay. So man management and the ability to maybe work backwards from the goal and break up into, let's call it micro cycles or smaller chunks, whatever you want to call it. Let's talk about the skills that you might feel like, oh, I'm on the back foot here, or maybe some opportunities you missed, or opportunities you didn't realize were so good.
Absolutely. I wish I had a better understanding of accounts and finance, and putting together, mirroring the project, but in numbers. Like, I wish I had a better understanding of that. And of course, like, we've all sort of worked to budgets in sport and what have you, most of the time asking for more. And
but it's not our money, is it? It's a big difference.
Yeah, exactly. No. That's our investment money, so every sort of penny really does count. I wish I'd probably had a better understanding of that, and I'm doing something about that now. You know, obviously, I need to. We do have a chief financial officer his responsibility is that, but I think as a CEO, it's important that we just don't go, that's his job. I need a solid understanding of that. And that, this links into something we've spoken about before. Information is not the thing that is going to separate us from other people right now. You have the same access to information that I have. A 21-year-old coming fresh, they have all the information in the world. They have it all. That's not the disparity in whether you're going to progress or not progress. It's the application of information and the understanding of people and stuff. You can't necessarily learn that. You can't really read a book on EQ and be able to then go and implement that. That can only come from experience and, not quite getting it. And then things are, that relationship is a broke down. I wonder what I did. I need to work on how I approach that relationship because it's not working now. I'm not getting from him what I feel like I need to be getting from him. So you can only really do that. You can only really do that with experience. But a critical thing for me, for like you say, your young guys, is it's not information. I don't have any more access to speed information than someone else. I'm just lucky that I've been around long enough that I can take that information as it's come out, effectively play around with it in a practical sense and learn and sort of learn my lessons and adapt and modify as we go, that's not where, and it goes back to our conversation about masters and PhDs and stuff. Information is there. Mm-hmm. It's the application of information that is setting us apart. I mean, obviously I'm trying to chat this out, but something that another project that we have got going is, I don't know if you know Chris Toombs, but Chris Toombs has come up with...
only through social media, but yes.
Yeah, so Toombs has been, years and years in the professions, same as ourselves. So he started Pegasus, which is it's almost like a counterpoint to everything that's happening at the minute. So there's a lot of sort of Zoom conferences going on. There's you can jump into any number of sort of online webinars and seminars and stuff. And what we wanted to do with Pegasus is get back to in person. So we've only got, I think, 25 people. But we have our first seminar, and there's myself, Faye Downey's coming over, who's she's been with Red Bull for years, and she's worked in British Athletics, and she's a really astute practitioner in the physical realm. There's obviously Chris Toombs. There's a whole load of guys down at INEOS in Portsmouth who are putting on this conference. And I think one of the things he's pushing is immersive learning, is getting in there and just, I'm going to do my contact and collision system, and they're going to do it. Like, I'm not going to say a word before the warm up. We're just going to do it, and then we're going to go through it afterwards, so they can feel it. They understand when I talk about non-linear strength development. Well, they're going to know what I'm going on about because they've just sort of done it. Yes. So they're going to have a better. They're going to be immersed in the conference. So hopefully that'll be interesting. So sorry, obviously the financial and the understanding of the financing behind business is something that I want to is what I want to get a handle on. And
would you say you recognize that now? If someone had told you back 15 years ago, go learn finances, go learn how to balance books, would you have taken it on?
No, I wouldn't. And I think because I was 100%, I wasn't ready because I didn't have the skills I needed to do what I needed to do. I wanted to be in professional sport. That's what I wanted to be in. That's all I wanted to do. And I was constantly trying to I don't know enough. I don't know. They're never going to employ me. I don't know enough. So I was just one-eyed in strength and conditioning. There was nothing on at the time. There was nothing I didn't read on Team Nation. Like every single word of every single article on Team Nation, I'd read it. And same with Louis. You touched on Louis, and I had all his tapes. I was in the gym doing box squats and band squat. That's what we were doing. When I look back, of course, I had the space to be slowly incrementing my skill set around finance and what have you. But at the time, I just didn't feel like I could do that. I was panicking that I wasn't good enough to do what I wanted to do. And what I wanted to do was to be in pro sport.
That's actually a good point that you make. Like, because I've never really thought of it like that. I thought it was my bullheadedness, but every spare second was reading, watching, downloading, whatever. Like, and anything that got in the way was actually a frustration. And so, I would be the same. And the funny thing is, my dad's a businessman, and he's been saying to me, just learn business, because then you can apply it to everything. Like, nah, I don't. Age 41 or whatever it is, or no, it was probably 38. I said, Dad, remember what you told me when I was 18?
You're right.
Yeah, you're right. He's become a wise old man, my dad.
Yeah, for sure. But I don't know. There's loads of stuff my sort of dad told me, and it was not till sort of around this age where I'm like, turns out he was right. And then obviously I'm trying to learn from that about how I present information to my kids. It's like, if I just tell them, they're not going to listen, because there's a disconnect between certainly father and son. It's just like, I can do it. I don't need you, Dad. I can do it. So I'm trying to work out how to get information across to them. I'm like, I'm not trying to be a dad here, but this is going to be critical for you. If, for instance, they're going, you know, that I'm sure it's the same for you, they're transitioning back to school and they're nervous and they're scared. And I'm like, that's fine. It's really important that you're nervous and scared. Don't run away from it. Don't try not to be nervous. Just understand that this is your body's reaction to making you sharp and making you astute at the time. You know, all you have to do is just put a cap on your nervousness, understand it, embrace it, understand that it's actually making you function pretty good, because, you know, everything's a little bit sharper when your adrenaline's up and, you know, you're feeling those nerves and stuff. Just grab it, be brave, and go with it, you know. And I'm just trying to work out how to better get across the lessons we learn to the younger generation without them going, oh, you don't even, you know, I'm doing Fortnite. What do you mean? You can't even play Fortnite. How can you tell me what to do when you can't even play Fortnite? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I totally get it. So then, let's take it from your children or your son or whatever family situation. A young coach approaches you, whether they're undergrad or just a new grad, and they say, hey, help me map up my career. What's the advice that you're going to, is it follow a path similar to you? Is it follow a totally different path? Is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, right? Because I'm trying to disconnect from bias and what have you. Like, when I look back, I feel really lucky. Like, there's just I've just collided with people along the way that just happen, you know, that's set up the next thing, which is set up the next thing. And it seems like, and I do believe you make your own luck. And, you know, I'm sure plenty of people connected with the same people I connected with, but either didn't leave enough of a positive impact with them or didn't fully maximize that relationship or what have you. I do feel like I've been me the whole time. I've just been me. And if people didn't like it, they didn't like it. And if people did like it, they did like it. Like me. So for instance, me and Dean Benson, when we worked together, we didn't really get on very well, because I was at Leicester. Leicester was like, we were the best team in the world. I didn't mean I was a good strength and conditioning coach, but we had 18 internationals on our roster. Like, it was pretty hard not to be good, to be honest.
Yeah.
We were winning stuff left, right and center. We couldn't help but win. And then, you know, Dean, and I've grown to, you know, be really good friends with him, but he has a way, and he was like, you lot don't know what you're doing. This is what we're doing. I was a bit like, hold on a minute. We won the Premiership last year, won the Cup the year before, and we finaled in Europe. Hold on a minute. And, you know, there was a little bit of a clash, but, you know, even though there was a clash, I don't think I modified who I was, and I don't think he modified who he was. And eventually we sort of came back around, and we, you know, I now refer to him as there's only a couple of people I would have learnt more off. Like, he was a massive influence in terms of, I wasn't ready for him at a certain stage, but, you know, that's the thing about the journey of life. Like, you reflect back and you realize you weren't ready. And it wasn't until someone else told me the same things he was telling me, and I was like, oh, turns out he was right.
Yeah, he was right,
you know. And, you know him, he's super smart, he's super driven, and he has a very good feel for developing athleticism over being a gym, you know, being a gym guy or being a speed guy. Has a very good feel about bringing a holistic ideal to preparing you for sport. So yeah, it was it's been interesting. But yeah, so going back to your question, I think aside from my bias, it would go back to what we spoke about. It's about experience. You know, do what you can do in terms of qualifications, because I still think there is a limit to the doors you can open without it. But it doesn't matter who you're coaching, really. It really doesn't. Like, my whole journey in mixed martial arts was, I just rocked up to the martial arts gym, started training, and then had a couple of conversations about, I think, nutrition and strength training. And then fast forward 5 years, and I'm cage side with Dan Hard against George St. Pierre for a title. You know, that it's, I would think that if someone saw a picture, they were like, oh, he's lucky. But, and it was lucky in certain ways, but it was also that I sort of had the balls to go down to mix from no martial arts experience, just going down to a martial arts gym and going, well, what do you do then?
Wait, and then, you know, just to clarify there, you went there as a trainee or with an intention of working with MMA?
A subplot to work, like, it was the sport I was very interested in. I didn't mm-hmm. necessarily understand it. I felt like, again, this is a little bit reflective, but so I was in a professional rugby team. So there's certain structuring and systems and processes that were just natural to a professional team that weren't natural to an amateur mixed martial arts team who were being paid. So they weren't professional because they didn't necessarily have a home and what have you, but they were, you know, they were being paid for doing their job. They didn't have those systems and structures. So to be perfectly honest, in the first instance, I just took structure and gave Rough House the structure that they would have if they were full-time professionals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it worked really well. But yeah, I went down to learn submission wrestling. That's what I went down to learn, because we were, you know, at Leicester, although Leicester was a juggernaut of a team, they were massive. They had like I said before, they had loads of sort of internationals on the roster. But one thing you could never take away from Leicester is that all of the staff were hungry for new information. So we were constantly in the office going, okay, we're pretty good, we're winning quite a lot here, but how do we get better? How do we get mm-hmm. better? How do we get better? And one of the, we were sat, they had a little wrestling room down in the basement of the Tigers training facility, and Kate Howley had come in and she'd done some judo stuff and she'd shown some stuff, and we'd had a couple of other people in, some combat guys in, and me and I think Alex Martin at the time were just sat at the back of the room going, yeah, I get it, but that's not going to happen. You know, mm-hmm. you don't have time to set stuff up at a rock. Like, it is what it is. It happens in a heartbeat. And I like the intention of the coaches going out and bringing Kate Howie in and what have you, but we were just like, there's a disconnect here. I understand, but I also understand that this isn't going to work. So off the back of that, I was like, look, I'll go figure it out. So I went down to Leicester Shoot Fighters, which is a mixed martial arts team, submission wrestling team, and I just sort of, you know, started doing their classes and was learning wrestling, learning positioning and learning control of people and how to manipulate people. And then the pros would come up and I'd just start chatting to the pros, and that led to that happening in that, you know, they had information I wanted and I had information that they wanted, and we just had this sort of skill set swap, and that's how that all came about, really. And, you know, once you dip your toe in martial arts, it becomes, you know, it's like the scales are taken away from your eye. You see how people are manipulating other people. You see about manipulating people's center of mass. You see about the physical cost of being manipulated and trying to manipulate people. And mm-hmm. it just lit up so many light bulbs for me about how that transfers into team sports and the tackle and the rock and what have you. And the sport became addictive being involved in it, because it was so real, and it was so close to, like, your nature. Like, there's most people's lives, there's been a confrontation where you're like, oh shit, are we having a fight here? Because it's, you know, we're not too far away from this being a fight, and you either have the fight or you don't have the fight. And it's, you know, obviously we've evolved, and as much as we can, we avoid physical confrontation, because I think we are a cerebral species who like to try and deal with stuff with words rather than physical confrontation. But in there and deep set in, you know, our reptilian brains, there is a there's a nature that is combative, you know, and the sport really sort of appeals to that in my nature, that it was really addictive to start trying to understand that. And I've been, you know, I'm still fascinated by it. And when I sit with Dan Hardy and I listen to his insights into movement and his insights into setting stuff up and making people do stuff that you want them to do without even touching them, just luring them into traps and stuff, it's just fascinating. And I'm still addicted to it.
Do you think that should be a bigger part of our development? You know, like we'll go do a weightlifting course.
It's happening now, mate. If you look, there's a lot of strength and conditioning coaches that took up jiu-jitsu in the last. I've noticed it because I won't even dare to suggest I was the first, but I think I was probably doing that before most sort of strength and conditioning coaches. But you've seen it now, and the crux that I've always took from it is you can develop mechanical strength and power in the gym. Of course, that has a place. We want to build bigger horsepower. We want to develop the ability to impart massive forces because we know that helps. But when you go into jiu-jitsu, it's about application of that strength and that power. And the more precisely you can apply that, you know, the better the results you're going to have. And that's not, you know, we always get set on one end of the spectrum or the other. That's not to devalue creating more strength and more power, but it's also don't ignore the fact that it's how you apply that strength and that power that might actually be the key determinant. And I see that in the grappling sense. But now, if you've, you know, you've been in this a while, you can see the trends of the profession. Now people are taking that into the speed scenario and the speed arena, and people are talking about, well, it's actually, yes, massive forces are really important, but can you get yourself into a position where you can apply that force efficiently and effectively, you know? And I see those three things are super, super correlated, you know, that conceptually, at least for me, it's about developing mechanical strength and power, but make sure you're addressing how you apply that strength and power as well. And I think you'll see, certainly on social media, there's a lot of guys starting to do jiu-jitsu. And I think that is that's almost something that they're subconsciously thinking about. Like, because, you know, we're strength and conditioning professionals, we're thinkers, right? We're constantly sort of thinking about, you know, how do I solve these problems? You know, everyone's not the same. It'd be great if we worked with robots, because you could just put your system in place and leave it. Yeah, but you know, it's not like that, and you're constantly trying to make stuff transfer better, make stuff apply stuff better. And I think there's a solid lesson in jiu-jitsu, and I think that's why people are finding it now. Like without being a gym numbers guy, like I was really strong when I went to jiu-jitsu. I was, you know, that was my life. I was a gym guy, and my first instructor, Nathan Leverton, he'd have been 60 kilos, I'd have been 90 kilos and gym strong, and it was no competition. My strength probably bought me about 30 seconds, and that was about it. I was at his mercy after 30 seconds, and that's the reality of it.
I remember, I'm no expert, but in 2005, I was doing Greco-Roman wrestling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And fairly strong, you know, gym strong, no impressive numbers, but it was the same thing. And Ollie, I was, you will pick up what the most important thing is. So I was the tallest, there were three stats, but the most important stat was that I was the least experienced. And was what stood out with me. It didn't matter what my bench press or squat or deadlift or clean or snatch was. It didn't matter if the guy was bigger than me or smaller than me. What mattered was who had more experience. And that was fascinating for me. Like the experience to be able to read cues and, like you say, form traps. And I would do these basic things, and just because it was my reaction, but he had been trained to anticipate my reaction.
Yeah, yeah. And every reaction you have, he has a counter to that. And then he has a counter based on that. Like when you, there's a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt called Victor Estima. And he's won the ADCCs. He's the nicest guy in the world. But the minute you engage with him, you're like, oh shit, I am, you know, it's like someone speaking fluent Japanese to you when you've never heard Japanese in your life. You're like, this is a mistake. And you've not even engaged properly. You just, you know, sort of come into a pond where you're just like, oh my God, I'm going to drown here. I'm going to drown in 30 seconds. I'm going to drown here. This is not a game for me. And it's just that level of, you know, they're telling you what you're going to do and you don't even realize they're telling you that. And then by the time you realize it's too late.
Do you know, and that was, before I did Greco-Roman, because I was in Australia, but in South Africa I did Thai boxing, whatever. And watching 50 kg women who would, you know, if you bumped someone that size and that frame, or you kind of got into a confrontation or whatever, hopefully you wouldn't, but if that ever happened, and then watching what they could do, and again, it was based on experience, not size, not strength, not male or female.
And
I made a promise to myself that I will walk away from any street fight until I've seen that person fight before. I'm not fighting them, because if they've got that background, whatever it is, they're just going to clean me up. And I remember...
It's frightening really, isn't it? It's frightening that people, I see this all the time, sort of on just social media videos of people street fighting, just like, you know nothing about fighting, but you're prepared to engage in a street fight. Like, someone can die out of this. You need to be really careful about when you decide to engage in this, because the one of the potential outcomes of this engagement is one of you is going to die. That's not unfit. You know, if you hit someone clean and they knock their head on the pavement,
Concrete.
You know what I mean? That it's not a game. It's serious. But sorry, going back, I would wholeheartedly suggest that people who want to be strength and conditioning professionals, they have some sort of grappling or mixed martial arts or something in their life, because there's some lessons that we've touched on that you're not going to learn that without doing it. There's two real things. One is your gym ego gets shattered by partaking in wrestling and mixed martial arts, and you also you learn that concept of application of strength and power. And it's the natural evolution for a professional. I think anyone ignoring that is going to have a rough time truly getting transfer. Like, if you just want to be a gym guy and you're chasing your gym numbers, that's great. That's only going to get you so far. And you're going to butt heads with the technical and tactical coaches at some stage, because it's not about gym numbers. It's about what happens on the field or the court or the dojo or whatever. And I think, I don't know if you'd agree, but I think if you're monitoring where people are at, I think people are getting there. There's less sort of gym guys that are just worried about gym transfers all over the place. Right? Everyone's talking about how we get better transfer now. And I think that's a positive move for what we're trying to do.
I'd agree with that. If I could add two other things that have definitely affected my career, less so with the Thai boxing stuff, more so with the Greco-Roman stuff, is two other valuable lessons I got for as a young S&C coach was the ways to manipulate the body weight, basically body weight training. And as a young coach, when you're working with the under 14 rugby team and you don't have access to the gym, and that was very important. And then the other one, which only really came into play years later, like I was doing some stuff with Skate Australia, so that's everything with a small wheel. And we did an injury prevention program and a falls prevention program. That was, actually three things.
Yeah, right.
So the falls and the ability to use your momentum and all that kind of stuff. And then the third thing that I got from specifically Greco-Roman, and bearing in mind I only did this for a couple of years, was neck strengthening, was integrated into my especially rugby union programs. Body weight, neck strengthening kind of work, you know, the bridging positions.
Thanks for segueing into the next thing I want to promote. one of the very, very close friend of mine, one of the fighters I used to look after when he was fighting, Dean Amersinger. Dean is now director of MMA for the UFC's Performance Institute in Shanghai. So he's over there doing something that is genuinely changing the way that you know, people prepare for mixed martial arts. It's an incredible, facility.
Okay, and I'm just going to cross promote here because we've interviewed Joseph Coyne and Gavin Pratt, who are two practitioners at Changha.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. We both get to promote something.
Yeah. So those guys, they're all part of the same team. Dean's obviously running the, in a team sport context, the technical and tactical side of it, and then I think Coyne is over the top as performance director and what have you. And I think they work very closely together to facilitate, like I was saying, it's just an unbelievable project. You know, we used to sit and chat about how amazing it would be to have like everything all in one place, and you know, the cutting edge sports science, the cutting edge recovery, and you know, that's what they're doing. And then they're doing some amazing things. That I think they, you know, they put out that first journal. I think at the minute they're working on a second journal that's, you know, it's going to be amazing. But anyway, so I've basically took Dean. Everywhere I've been, I've took Dean with me as a consultant. He's dropped in, and over the years we've developed a system for preparing team sports players for contact and collision. Because in my experience, it's sort of like pre-season, right, contact. And there was no progression to get you to contact. It was just like maybe you hit some pads to start with, but that was about it. Mm-hmm. So we've put together this system, which we're going to eventually put online. I think we're going to start filming next month, which touches on what you were sort of saying. So level one is just about you and your body weight, crawling, dragging, carrying. It's almost, it's a combination of sort of active mobility, some non-linear strength positions where you're having to tolerate your body weight moving through space. At joint positions that are difficult for you. And that sort of leads on to level two, which is sort of partner based, a lot of carrying, like wheelbarrow walks and dragging each other, which then leads on to sort of level three and level four, which is taken from grappling and Greco and what have you, where we introduce pommeling, we introduce semi-competitive games for basically just gradually ratcheting up the amount of contact and the amount of impact that you're taking. So you don't just go from gym to smashing each other with the technical coaches. There's a segue there, and something that I'm absolutely, obviously it's our system, so I'm going to say this, but I hope, especially transitioning out of sport, I hope I have people will see that if it didn't work, I would have been promoting it, because I don't need to promote this, but the system works. It solidifies. Loads of people that I've worked with who've had shoulder reconstructions, they're like, by the end of preseason, like, you know, I just feel solid around my shoulders and my neck. I feel confident going into collisions. It does something. It's not one of those things where it's not like I'm not going to run off. You know, if I say to you, I'm selling you a speed system and we run flying tens and your speed, it improves, then obviously I can show you that what I've done is changed, you know? So it's not one of those things. It's just, it's a system that I'm wholeheartedly telling you that if you do this system, you are better prepared for collision and contact by the end of it. I can only say that out of the experience of doing it with teams over the years, that it's had an impact, and undoubtedly the feedback has always been positive. It's like, I feel better. I feel ready. That's awesome. For collision. I sort of can't wait to hit people type thing. We've worked on that. We've developed that over sort of the last decade, really. And we've got it to a point where I think we're ready to put it out there. And coaches, I think defense coaches will be really interested in it, because I think it will give them an extra string to their bow. And I definitely think S&C guys will be very interested in it, because again, we're looking for that transition from gym to field and how we manipulate transfer and how we optimize transfer and stuff. So it'll be interesting to see.
Be on the lookout for that, definitely.
Yeah.
Now, Ollie, I'm super conscious that we've already taken up an hour and 15 minutes of your time, so I really appreciate it. It's been fascinating as always. I've taken a bunch of notes here.
All good. Any time, mate. I'm writing my own schedule now. So
Of your own time. Awesome. Well, thanks.
Appreciate being off the command. There's some impressive people that have been on here, so I feel privileged to be on here.
It's funny. I just love these because I get to learn so much. I ask the exact questions. You know, some of, when we started off, a lot of those were people that were, you know, I catch up with fairly regularly and said, hey, can we do this on? Actually, that's how it started. It said, hey, can my interns just jump in on this? And then we kind of went out from there. But yeah, thanks very much for your time and wishing Full Reptile the best. Like, it's funny, in the last probably I can actually feel it, like last 5 or 6 years, if I see someone taking a risk or having a crack, I just want to support them. Like, it's just cool to watch.
Like, it's just exciting, right? It's just stepping out, effectively putting your balls on the line. I've moaned about enough CEOs. Well, now I'm this CEO. So,
you're the CEO.
You know, I don't know if you've read Extreme Ownership with Jocko Willink, but it had a big impact on me. He's a bit like America and what have you, and he's like carbon, you know, cut out of a Marine or Special Force or whatever. But it had a big impact on me in that, you know what, it is on me, mm-hmm. and that's fine. Like, I want that. I want to be, if there is a problem, I want to be responsible for it, you know, and you know, let's go with it and see what we can do. And if work ethic gets you anywhere, we'll be all right. Cause we're used to that as coaches. We're used to work ethic.
100%. Awesome. Well, thanks very much.
Appreciate it, mate.
I want to get this processed and get it up as quickly as possible. And I'll let you know when it's on, and thanks for your time.
Lovely. Enjoyed it, mate. Speak to you soon.
All right. See you.